I went home last Wednesday or Tuesday, whenever it was, extremely frustrated over the generalizing that's being done up here, knowing that those of you who come on Sunday morning are quite used to it and know how to sort through it and work it out and be very benevolent. But I shall move on ahead because I'm really convinced that there is, for many of us, particularly for the better marriages, more help to be found in a generalized overview than there is when it's said in such a precise way that I cannot be misquoted, and that if I am, I can prove I was right. Now, I'm saying this from the standpoint of the speaker. So I shall continue, but because this is part two, let me just reiterate very quickly. I tried to say three basic things last week. Number one, that sex, at least in one of its highest forms, is a communication form. That it isn't just for babies anymore. That it is probably the most succinct way I communicate what I really feel to the partner in my life. Now, the problem is, I don't necessarily see it that way, but they always do. That is very, very important. That's one of the things I thought about after I left. It was in my notes, but I couldn't read it. I always like the definition of inspiration is that which you think of on the way home anyway. But it really occurred to me that this is really where the problem is. The other partner always perceives sex as the deepest form of my communicating what I really feel toward them. Love, respect, utilitarianism, use, misuse, abuse, whatever. They perceive it that way. So it's real critical that I get on board as the other partner, that we get on board to know that that's the way they are reading sex. Therefore, I do need to use it to perceive it as a communication form. Someone raised the question in the talk back afterwards if the voice wasn't all right also. Well, sure, I give you my permission to say something if you want to say it, and that's also a way of communicating. I don't think it's nearly as interesting. I don't think it's nearly as communicative, but please accept if you need my approval on that, be sure to use your voice. I'm just saying it's not the primary form of communication in marriage as really conveying feelings. Secondly, I said there is far more to marriage than sex. But from what I perceive and all the reading I've done, which is extensive, there is nothing that affects marriage more than sex. Marriage is much more than sex. But nothing tells you more about a marriage than sex, and nothing affects marriage more than sex. I use the two words thermometer and thermostat. It is both. It is a thermometer, and it is a thermostat. And then thirdly, sex has been made increasingly difficult and a much higher cause of problem in marriage because we've lived in a media society that has constantly given us imagery and stimuli that has not only disoriented our expectations, but has overstimulated our emotions. And this has caused great disruption. You know, we not only give out medals and awards for performance now, but we also know when we don't deserve that medal and that award. And that's probably more detrimental to a marriage than anything else, the fact that media has told us. Now, part two really deals with, okay, what do you do about this? That sounds more interesting already than it's going to be. Now, what I'm going to tell you, in my opinion, is sound. It's just not what you're hoping for. What we tend to hope for is high concentration on what's the word? Performance is the one I want to use. This is not going to be a class on sexual performance because that's not the problem. That's one of the symptoms of the problem and one of the contributing factors to the problem. Though, I do want to say that shouldn't be put down either. There's a real place for that. There's a place for experimentation and flexibility. In other words, someone said, I did too much talking last week without documenting it, and I don't even remember where I read this, but someone said that one of the fundamental problems in the average couple's sex life is that when they do have sex, they have it in the same place, in the same way, the same form, no difference. And that is true. And I got to thinking about that. We don't do that anywhere else. When you eat, sometimes you eat in the kitchen. Sometimes you eat in the dining room. Sometimes we eat out on the patio. Sometimes we go down here to Burger King or somewhere else and buy some. You're getting ahead of me. And go out to Lake Alice to eat. There's a real place for flexibility. And especially if we have some sort of neurotic or Victorian or antiquated uptightness or pathological orientation, pathos logos, this inner hurting that expresses itself by being too rigid. I think there's a real place for that. And there's enough self-help manuals on it. And by that, I don't mean Playboy and Penthouse, because they are the antithesis. I won't get into that. I've already been reprimanded once. But there are self-help manuals. What I want to talk about, I want to draw liberally, at least initially, from Dr. Andrew Greeley, sociologist, University of Arizona, who has coined the answer to part one in one word, fidelity. Now remember, I'm really excited about sharing this because I think it's intrinsically practical. But remember, one of the things I tried to share last week is that sexual satisfaction is cerebral. People who are deeply satisfied in their sex life, it has very little to do with performance. Now, they think it does, and when they're trying to improve it within their home, that's one of the preoccupations. But that's just another way of saying we tend to be preoccupied with symptoms and not causes. But when you really get at the key to the thing, you're getting into something that's deeply cerebral. Sexual satisfaction does not come in the degree or the length of orgasm or climax. It doesn't come in performance or the awarding of medals, but it's cerebral. Now, the word fidelity is really difficult to use because being faithful always has implicit the idea of not getting into someone else's bed. And of course, that is implicit and it is there. And I do want to talk about that a little bit, but not in its fundamental form. The word fidelity primarily comes from a Greek word, pistuo, really from a Latin word, but deeply as all Latin is rooted in the Greek, which really means to hang in there. Let me translate it in literal Greek. Hang in there with them, come hell or high water. Now, this has a greater impact on sex and sexuality, sexual gratification and sexual pleasure than any known technique, in my opinion, in my perception. Let me put it another way. The word is hard because there's probably more sexual infidelity among married couples who are never getting in anybody else's bed than there is among married couples who get in someone else's bed. Now, I want to elaborate that on that some more, but that's very critical. You see, come back to the Greek word porneria, pornography. The Bible, and I've tried not to quote Bible because I'm trying to maintain this on a very secular basis, which is the way it ought to be under this setting. But the word porneria literally means, from the Greek word porneria, literally means to use you for my needs. And when the Bible says abstain from fornication, it's literally saying don't use somebody to make yourself feel good. Okay, there is more fornication probably going on inside marriage than outside of marriage. There is certainly as much sexual sin inside marriage as outside marriage. Somebody raised the question last evening, last week when during the question and question period. Isn't it possible to have a relationship outside of marriage that is not pornographic? I'm using the wrong words now, porneria. And literally, this is true. When I do not abuse and use, now I know I'm leaving myself wide open, and but I'm just trying to respond as honestly as I know how. I'm not advocating anything. I'm not suggesting that you go out and do whatever feels good. I'm just saying that the mistake we make is that we say, I'm married, therefore I am not guilty of certain sins. And I'm saying any marriage counselor with any theological background at all who perceives at all what the word hamartia, sin, literally means, and porneria literally means. Hamartia means to take something that's good and make it bad, and porneria means to use somebody for your own feelings. So I'd like to do away with that churchy parochialism and deal with the concept of the type of fidelity that is basically positive. Just being faithful to someone doesn't mean just not getting in somebody's bed. It means to stay with them. In other words, put it in another setting. Let's just take a football illustration. Moving to Athens and moving to Tuscaloosa isn't the problem if you live in Gainesville and move out of Gainesville and you don't support the team. See, fidelity means to hang in there. I gave you a quote that I thought was awfully good from Greeley. For fidelity is the striving toward permanence. It's in your notepad. It is a striving toward permanence, a longing for a love that does not end. Now, you can't get that in an affair. You can get more sexual gratification immediately in an affair because that's an immature thing, and there is high input into the emotions, which in fact increase sexual response, which in fact increase sexual orgasm. But to build a relationship, and relationships are what we're looking for, you see, having affairs with people, whether you're married or not, does not really produce what people are looking for when they're looking for a fidelity experience, a longing for a love that does not end. Someone has said that it's not how much you love somebody, but it's how deeply you love them. It's being married until death do us part, not as long as we both shall love. It is a permanent commitment to reach out for the other person, a promise to persist in efforts to transcend the distances between. Everybody's got distances between. You're just kidding yourself when you look at that other marriage and you say, boy, aren't they close. Everybody is in public. And even the close ones are at home, except when they hate each other. And that comes regularly enough to keep them on their toes. You know, we often seek a faith that lifts us out of normality. And we hear Paul say, don't let the sun come down on your anger. And we think that means you can't get angry. You ought to get angry. It's just you don't live that way. You don't make it a habitual orientation. Let the day close so that you begin another day like that. But transcend the distances. A firm resolve to sustain the relationship no matter what difficulties arise. Well, those difficulties of fidelity, sometimes there is unfaithfulness. I tread on this lightly because it is a rampant problem in most cities. I think it's probably more true of university cities. I'm hedging now. I'm sure it is, though I don't know that it is, though I do know it is. And the reasons are very obvious. There's just more of what Carl Jung called synchronicity. I mean, if you're driving a car in a town where there's where there's only two cars, your chances of colliding are not all that big. But if there are 1,000 people, 10,000 people, and half of them are neurotic, are lonely, are insecure, are frightened, there's a heightened degree of synchronicity. So it's not that Gainesville's full of evil people, it's a matter of synchronicity. Both, but synchronicity mostly. Not really. So there is the problem of other people, but I want to come back to that. But there are other forms of infidelity that I think come much closer. You see, I get so excited I forget what I'm saying. I don't know whether exciting is the word or not. But the reason I'm not making such a big deal over marriage infidelity is because what usually causes that are other forms of infidelity within the home. For instance, all day long, her unconscious desire, or his, seems to be to disparage him in the eyes of the children, raising her eyebrows when he says something, exchanging looks with the children, an ironic glance with a son or daughter when he made a simple remark, appearing somehow to criticize his opinions, his dress, even his appearance. Why, that's the most common form of infidelity. And certainly the most lethal in sex. See, this is what I'm saying. There's more infidelity inside marriage if we're not careful. Because when I am not faithful to that slob, and he may be, or that whatever you call women, I just know more about men than women. But when I'm not faithful, and when he says something or she says something, and I look at my son or my daughter and I raise my eyebrow, this is the beginning of the answer. It's not the end. It's sort of like Churchill's statement at El Alamein, the first major Allied victory. Churchill said, this is not the end. It's not the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning. This is where it starts. Utter faithfulness. And if this guy is a loser, or if this guy is inconsiderate, or if he's a bum, or just mama's little boy, and all kind of pathological orientations, until I am faithful to him and see him through it and not trade him off to win the favor of my daughter or my son, as we are more superior to him, there is no real hope for that home, and he's probably going to have an affair. I'm saying that affair is more symptomatic than anything else. Or how about this? Wives who discuss their husbands at the club. The country club, wherever people go and sit together, to sit there with three or four other women or men discussing their wives, this is not fidelity. Or the husband who mourns to other women of how much they are misunderstood. Poor baby. But that's infidelity. You see, until I develop a relationship where my wife, and it may be as much her fault as mine, where my wife and I talk about the fact that she does not understand me, until there's that kind of faithfulness in a marriage, there will seldom be wonderful family orgies. Bearing sad tales of this and that injustice, or going home to mother, or talking about his or her extravagancy, or his or her cruelty. All these things may be. But you see, fidelity is not basically just trading them in for somebody else. What is far more important is why we feel the need to make these trades, because we don't feel that important. So, in a primary and positive way, it means that married lovers are committed to developing their whole relationship, including their sex life. Sexual fidelity then means enriching and expanding this physical communication form with one's partner, no matter how many disappointments and failures may occur. Let me use another Greek word. I've used it on Sunday. It's the Greek word agios. It's the word we translate holy. It's the word we translate saint. The Bible says you are called to be a saint. But we think of a saint, I always have, as I've said before, as an old lady sitting on a front porch in a rocking chair who was too old to sin. That's what the word saint always conjured up for me. In the literal Greek, it means somebody who has set their sight on a distant goal and is going to go there no matter how many times they blow it. And how deeply I respect people who in their faith just blow it. Do some dumb, stupid thing just like I do. But don't just lie there and feel sorry for themselves. Get up and keep at it. And I'll tell you something else. I know a few things that are more disruptive to married life than getting in somebody else's bed. And yet, where grace is, sin does, where sin is, grace doth much more abound. I have seen people who have just blown it that much, who have gotten up and kept on coming, and have built a relationship they may never had before because there was nothing in their lives to shake them up, and most of us don't look up till we're flat of our backs. So, it is loyalty to the other person. But then I want to go on to say that it's loyalty to yourself. Very few people learn to use the thermometer, as sex is, correctly, until they learn that being loyal to myself is also important. Not to be a doormat. Men particularly have very little loving capacity toward women who are doormats. I can't tell you how many marriages I have seen finally saved when somebody finally said, "Get out, I can't take it anymore." And you see, it's not because they couldn't take it that's so much the big problem, as that they were living in such an understanding way. People don't want to live with doormats. And any time you abdicate your rights in anything, it is detrimental to the whole. Who said it? Affirm like yourself. Affirm yourself. God didn't make no junk. You're not junk. But by that same token, and being honest about yourself and faithful to yourself, is don't be a rug either. We play so many games where we sweep things under the rug. I read something the other day from Dr. Leonard Lovshin of the Cleveland Clinic. He said, if a woman patient repeatedly tells you during history taking that my husband is just wonderful, doctor, especially when you never ask about her husband, you can bet you're dealing with a neurotic, or at least a neurotic marriage. I figured that the marriage in such a case is likely to be on the rocks within a year or so, because I'm a husband, and most of my friends and associates are husbands, and I don't know a wonderful one in the life. If your patient will admit to herself that she's married to a typically inconsiderate guy, there's a chance she's normal and hope for the marriage. Now, if you're here tonight and you're not married to a typical inconsiderate guy, don't be disappointed. It's just that most people are. And yet, being true to ourselves, we sweep it under the rug and we talk about how happy we are. How happy we are. So quit saying it. If you're so happy. Ruth Stafford Peale, I never like to identify people by their husband. I think that's terrible, but I'm going to anyway. Norman Vincent's wife said about this problem of loyalty to self, now actually she wasn't referring to this, but it's very applicable, that there are three basic elements that I've got to consider when I'm really being loyal to myself. Number one, every person needs to feel that they march at the head of some other person's parade. And I owe that to myself. And if you see, this we're still really on the subject of fidelity, and we'll be all evening, just broadening it. You owe it to me, if I'm married to you, to know that I march at the head of your parade. Even if you get out of line, you get back in. Agios, because I'm that important, and you at least had enough maturity to see it. That his happiness and welfare comes first, ahead of all other happiness and welfare. That he or she is number one. That's important. This sense of being able to claim complete priority. Now, priority. I think of something here that's so normal. I see so very often people who are attracted to other people. And just, well, I'm hard-pressed here. Let me tell you about Sandra. That's the easiest way to handle it. That's my wife, for those of you who don't know. 2 or 3 years ago, up to last year, when we went to football games on University Avenue, was a traffic cop that she thought was the best-looking guy in the whole world. Now, let me tell you something. You know these guys on TV today that are all bent out of shape because their wives have to hug the charmin in public? They don't know what real agony is. Suppose you were a big, important minister. And you have to drag your wife across University Avenue, drooling all over the place. But that's so normal. Let me tell you, when Auburn was here last year, they had a majorette. That was one of the most beautiful, sweetest looking girls I have ever seen. I've been madly in love with her ever since. Now, do you know why I thought she was beautiful and sweet? Because she looked beautiful and sweet. That's why. And everybody relates to someone in some level or another. Doesn't mean there's nothing there, and it doesn't mean there is something there. It's normal. We go through this sort of thing constantly. But you see, the thing about Sandra that I am utterly sure of is that I walk at the head of her parade and that I claim complete priority in her life. Absolutely, no question of that. That's the best you're going to get. Better settle for it. And it's great. Secondly, now number one is every person needs to feel that he marches at the head of someone's parade. We're still talking about being loyal to yourself. Secondly, the second basic hunger is that everybody needs somebody else's strength. And that is especially true of those of us who say we don't. Not putting that person down. I'm just saying that whenever you hear somebody say, I don't need you, I don't need them, I don't need any help, this person usually is in the deepest trouble. But the second basic hunger that's important for me to guard in my life is that everybody needs somebody else's strength. I need your strength, and you owe that strength to me, and you have no right to spend it on somebody else. How many marriages and how many thermostats are turned way down until there is rampant frigidity throughout the house, simply because I take my strength and I give it to the boys or my secretary who's having marital troubles. I'm not talking about going to bed with her. I'm just saying talking to her. And I go home and tell my wife to be quiet. I'm nervous and I've been working too hard. Nobody here does that, but in some places they do. But I've got a right for you to help me. I'm sure glad my wife's not here, because when I spend all day with you and I go home, I don't want to hear her say anything. You know, I say, don't talk to me about our marriage problems. We don't have any. If we do, it's you. I don't want to talk about it. But she has a right to insist on that, and she does. She's not a doormat. Because she's not a doormat, I find her exciting. Thirdly, Everyone needs to be needed. I need your strength, but I need you to need me. And you are being an adulterer, taking that which is good, the literal sense of the term. If you don't let me give to you, everyone needs to be needed. I read somewhere the other day where a guy said, what really hurts me is when my wife goes on vacation, and a separate vacation from me, or she's out of town in her business, and she writes back and addresses the letter occupant. I heard somebody say one time, he said, my mother loved me, but she died. You know, they're just people who just, I have a right to be needed. Someone put it this way, the most important thing in life is to love someone. The second most important thing in life is to have someone love you. The third most important thing in life is to have both happen at the same time. Again, Ruth Peel put it this way, and I put this in your letter, in your note too. Marriage, we're often told, is difficult and a demanding challenge. But perhaps we make it too complicated. I believe that's true. I'll say more about that next week. But perhaps we make it too complicated. In the last analysis, it's just a relationship in which human beings try to find release and fulfillment. And they don't ask so very much. To come first with someone. To be helped by someone. To be needed by someone. Three things, that's all. But that's enough. And I know that's so. Oh, I know there is deep pathological, pathogenic neurosis in marriages. Psychosis. Deeply disturbed people, mentally ill, emotionally disturbed. I know that. And I know that virtually everything I've said in these weeks is not all that applicable to them. But I'm saying in the average, normal, run-of-the-day family, possibly 90% of the homes, those three would make the big difference. And as far as sex goes, I personally cannot think of a thing that contributes more to sexual gratification than the kind of loyalty I've been talking about. Now let me just summarize it or bring it to consummation by just mentioning two or three basic keys to just beginning with this sense of loyalty, this willingness to work through it, this willingness to hang in there and break through that emotional frustrating ceiling I talked about in the first session, that first banyan tree, or at least the second banyan tree, or if you're in the third one, at least the third banyan tree, but somewhere break through that and begin to deal with the real issues. These are some keys that have been helpful to me in my marriage. Still learning how to work some of them in the lock. But number one, concentrate on the present and the future. We don't like to do this. Neil O'Hara said, a man who says he can read his wife like a book rarely does. Instead of skipping what he doesn't like, he goes over it and over it and over it and over it. Here's a Don Bain joke. I just saw Don come in. Now, I hadn't heard him say this. It just sounds like Don Bain. Two men discussing their wives. Argument. Well, when we get in an argument, she becomes historical. No. He said, you mean hysterical. No, I mean historical. Well, we do tend to do that. We need to put the past behind. Now, obviously, there is continuity, and there are things that have to be reached back and picked up that really tie in with the present, is what Martin Buber, the Jewish philosopher, called the isness of the was and the wasness of the is. And there's no real way to deal with pathological problems till we know the isness of the was and the wasness of the is. But in the average marriage, to concentrate on the present and the future. I heard a sermon one time from this church. In fact, I preached it. And those of you who come here know I talk more to myself than anybody else. If you get in the way, that's your problem. but why windshields are bigger than rearview mirrors. And that's why. Because we need to be, people who spend their time looking in rearview windows, mirrors always run into something else. And synchronicity is greatly increased by that. Grave diggers. And that's true when the times were happier. One of the things I tried to say in the first session is the problem, the reason good marriages often go bad is they have so many good times. And then they get in those normal periods of adjustment brought on by whatever, be it menopause or the theory of the 7, the 14, the 21 year, which is very suspect but has a lot of interesting credibility. Whatever brings it on, they tend to look back and say, remember how it was. This is what I was saying last week about sex. We're so pumped up today that sexual experiences in a normal relationship tend to drop just in intensity, but we tend to look back on how it used to be, and we spend all of our time looking in rearview mirrors. Number one, key number one, concentrate on the present and the future. That's where it can be so good. I've just appreciated so much the single couples. Single couples. That comes from a Greek phrase. You know, that's the only thing in this church I can bluff on. There's an authority on everything else. Once we get a Greek scholar here, I'm going to quit. But that's the one thing I've appreciated most about so many of the singles who have been here throughout these sessions. Some of them are just very simply saying, I'm going to look at the future. I'm going to ask about the isness of the was and where I failed, but I'm going to look at the future. That's a big key. Key number two is to accentuate the positive. I heard someone say a couple weeks ago, that two major birds fly over the California desert. One is a vulture, and the other is a hummingbird. One is looking for rotten, decaying flesh, and the other is looking for the small little flowers in the cactus plants. And they both find what they're looking for. That's true. Accentuate the positive. Let me say it again. Because some of you don't know this. Everybody is hard to live with. Now, you knew who you were with was, but you didn't know everybody else was. Everybody is hard to live with. But the couples who build a relationship so much more exciting, even sexually, than an affair, but who build a relationship out of that are those who learn to accentuate the positive. We've all seen it in our marriage where negative cycles breed negative cycles. I say something, she reacts. I say more, she reacts. And this gets to be a tremendous negative down spiral. The same thing is true of the positive. When I say something that's positive, he reacts, which breeds positiveness, which breeds reaction. And it goes on and on. I was reading the other day about a girl who said her husband was just the most thoughtless, inconsiderate person in the world. And she finally decided after 13 years of marriage to quit talking to him about it. Well, that's pretty perceptive. So finally one day he brought home a book from his office that she said I had asked for 4 times. Finally he brought it home, and when he brought it in the door, I acted like it was a brand new diamond necklace. She said I threw my arms around him and was just so excited about it. She said he looked at me rather oddly, but I could see he was pleased. I did this a few more times, and gradually he began to want to think about me because he enjoyed being appreciated. And there is a negative cycle. When I say to my little boy, don't walk through the mud puddle, he's going to walk through the mud puddle. He probably wouldn't have thought of it. I get ready to go to the store and I say, Junior, don't poke peas up your nose. And then I come home and here's this poor little guy with peas all poked up his nose. And I say, what kind of juvenile delinquent am I raising? Well, the same kind you're married to. We don't tend to disappoint each other. That's a fact. We don't tend to disappoint each other. And when people begin to expect thoughtfulness and expect kindness and reward thoughtfulness and reward kindness, oh, it doesn't happen the way we want it to happen. Just like that, all of a sudden, zap, shazam, he's a new man. But it can lead to an awfully interesting marriage and do wonders for your sex life. Building on the positive. There are four ways to do that. I got this out of the Reader's Digest. Carl Clark from the University of Florida. I don't know whether he's still around or not. Anybody know Carl Clark? Was on the staff over there for some years. He said, if you want to build on the positive in your marriage, do four things. This was helpful to me. Number one, take inventory. Ruth Peale makes this suggestion in her marriage counseling. She says that at a point in marriage counseling, she asks the couple to sit down and spend 30 minutes saying nothing to each other. Well, they're very well rehearsed at that, and they're no big deal. So they sit down and spend 30 minutes saying nothing to each other. And then they spend 30 minutes talking about the things they have in common. And it usually runs over. And then she says, take 30 minutes and talk about the things that really are different between you. And that takes way less time than 30 minutes. But we accentuate the negative. Clark says, take inventory. What are the things that hold you together? And in most marriages, they are 15 to 1. But we accentuate the negative. And that's normal. When we've got one nail in our shoe that's sticking through into our foot, we're much more aware of it than the other 87 that are behaving themselves. But when you get into it emotionally, the other 87 is what we're giving up for the one sticking in our foot. That's why most divorced people will tell you their divorce was a mistake, and that the divorce was worse. Being divorced was worse than working out the marriage. Not all, but most. Take inventory. Secondly, reach back. By that, he simply means that there was something you had in common. How many couples meet on the tennis court, have a marvelous courtship playing tennis, get married, buy a house, have a baby, and give tennis up, never to come back to it sometime except to save their marriage? Reach back. Reach back. There are things every couple had in common that made them attractive to one another that most marriages tend to give up till they've got to return to them, and then often it's too little too late. In our lives, as I said, in our early marriage, well, even before we were married, we loved to walk in the woods. I guess that sounds suspect, and it was. But we loved the woods. And then when we first got married, we bought a trailer, and we went camping in the woods. And then we bought a little farm in Tennessee, and we spent all of our time there we possibly could. Then about a year ago, we went through some rocky times in our marriage. Just several weeks, actually 2 or 3 months, that were just, you know, I kept thinking, maybe she'll have a heart attack. I mean, I don't want to kill her because I couldn't get away with that. And I know she was thinking about that wonderful guy back in high school. Gosh, I'm tired of hearing about him. And that went on, you know, we weren't saying all this, but it was about 2 or 3 months where it just wasn't all that wonderful. You know what turned that around? We reached back. We bought a little old trailer. Got holes in the tent. And it's so small I can pick the tongue up with one hand. But we reached back. Now, I'm not saying that's the only thing that saved our marriage. I'm just saying you've got to work at it. How to accentuate the positive. Number one, take inventory. Number two, reach back. Number three, I've touched on this, reward each other. That's hard. The word I use most in trying to communicate the greatest hope in rebuilding a marriage, I use most in private counseling, is the hardest word to really convey to anyone. And once you get it conveyed, it's the hardest word to expedite and facilitate. And that's the word vulnerability. Being vulnerable is hard. I say, reach out to him. I did, and he cut my hand off. And I understand. Gosh, who wouldn't understand? It's hard to reach out again. How many people say after a divorce, I can't reach out again? Buddy, if you're not vulnerable, you're going to be a bruised cripple all your life. Being vulnerable. It's a hard word to describe. This is a very unapt illustration, I'm sure, but the best illustration I can think of is me being here. Really and truly, I can stay here on Sunday morning and give you 3 points in a poem, and they're well thought out, and I'm not putting my preparation down or what I'm saying, certainly what I'm saying, but I am being vulnerable because I know I will hurt some people more than I will help them, but maybe help a lot more by just sharing my own pilgrimage in marriage. And I've got to decide that how I feel and what I gain from it is not as important as reaching out. Vulnerability in marriage, especially when things are not going right, the ability to say, I'm going to try again to put my arms around you, and even if you cut them both off, I'm going to put the nubs around you. Now, when you cut it off to the elbow, you've gone too far because I've got my rights. But I'm going to go as far as you'll let me go. Fourthly, use positive definitions. I think one of the most salutary things that can happen in a marriage perspective is when I realize that, as I said in session one, many of the things that attract me most to a certain human being is because I sense that they can meet my neuroses and I can meet theirs. That's when we get this, wow. And then in marriage we get the conflict because the very things we hope they could help us on become... I came to them, there was a sense that there could be a wholeness in this relationship that was more than just a marvelous Academy Award orgasm. Not putting that down, I'm just saying there's more. See, the problem with sex today is that we've minimized it rather than maximized it. And to realize, for instance, someone said, I don't think I can live another year, 15 years, don't think I can live another year having to reassure her that she's still pretty and still attractive. But then when he began to see that the deepest compliment that can be paid is to select someone who can take me with my thorns and my roses, with my real strengths and my neuroses, with my little kid that's a runny-nosed brat, and with my little kid that's charming, and love me and help me grow up, why she not ask anybody else to spend 15 years with her? Because she didn't trust them enough to believe that they would carry her in that insecurity that had to come. And there's a whole new perspective when we use the positive definitions. Of course, this also involves communicating with one another, just plain talking. I think one of the problems in marriage, I've seen a lot of and had trouble with in my own marriage, is that I've said very many times before that one of the problems is when we get married, we leave our brains at the altar, or at least at the office. And one of the assumptions when we do that is that now I don't have to be diplomatic. And there are things we need to say to each other. There are things that we need to convey. But Roger Rosenblatt put it this way: all criticism, be it casual or vicious or constructive, is unpalatable. Sure, you can profit in the long run, long and painful run, but taking it is something else. Taking it means letting it go down like custard. No blinking, no flinching, no wishing you were dead. Well, you've got a great marriage when that can happen. When somebody is so sensitive about the positive relationship that if there does have to be negative criticism, it is couched in real diplomacy. Nobody in the world needs to be more diplomatic than married people. And the assumption is the longer you're married, the less diplomacy is required. So be positive. Always accentuate the positive, because it's the only hope you've got. That's real fidelity. That's real faithfulness. Because negative breeds negative and positive breeds positive. And not only that, as I come down to the end, I just want to say, like this handsome policeman who my wife thinks was just gorgeous, I hated his badge. Most of the thoughts and feelings we have are normal, healthy, everyday run-of-the-mill. But we live in such a superficial world, so bombarded by what I constantly call subliminal stimuli, which is a good phrase, those things that course into my mind, that orient my thoughts without my even knowing it. We live in such a world like that, that normal thoughts we sweep under the rug and we just don't leave them out to laugh at. You know, a sense of humor is probably the most redeeming thing in any relationship. The ability to laugh. Webster defines humor as a state of mind of flexibility or the ability to perceive the absurd. And I know that people who have a pathological background without humor are hard-pressed to have it, but we can know that most of our thoughts are normal. 90% of the people. Here's a good illustration of the problem. It says it succinctly. We have a Marine pilot in this church that was in the Marines in the Second World War. I was just a little boy then, but I was old enough to be conscious of everything that was going on, all the planes, and I knew them by sight. And he and I were discussing a couple of years ago the P-38, which is very prominent in the Pacific War. Was a fascinatingly interesting plane. It was a sleek-looking plane for that day, much like the Mustang and the Messerschmitt on the German side, but it was an American P-38, the Curtiss Bell Air Cobra, it was called. But it had the engine up under the seat, and there was a long drive shaft out of the propeller. And I asked him, what was it like to fly that plane in combat? And he said a very interesting thing. He said that plane had very strange characteristics, that when you were at high altitude and you peeled off in a dive, when you reached a certain speed, the plane went completely out of control. Just began end over end, which, you know, really kind of catch your attention if nothing else. He said the seasoned pilots knew what to do. And I don't know how you got to be a seasoned pilot flying one of those things. But he said you took your hand off the stick and you took your feet off the accelerator and you gripped the seat and you held on and you let it reduce its airspeed, because he said The plane didn't like that any better than you did. And when it reached the right speed, it would level itself off, and you could fly it again. But he said the problem with inexperienced pilots was that they grabbed the stick, fought that plane right into the sea. That's what we do with our thoughts. Normal thoughts. Healthy thoughts. Everyday run-of-the-mill thoughts that run all the way from titillation to simulation to fantasy to thoughts that just need to be appreciated and laughed at and not fought into the ground until we become neurotic in our marriage, as we often are in our faith, by fighting just normal thoughts and thinking that the thought itself is the sin, where it's only doing it or living that way in your mind that becomes sin. So, accentuate the positive. That's the critical thing. I believe that when you talk about sex in marriage, and when you talk about the problem of the inner child, the pathological problems of our model orientations of our childhood, whatever you say about these things, for the average normal person, the critical thing, and I close with these words again, Ruth Peale. Marriage, we're often told, is difficult and a demanding challenge, but perhaps we make it too complicated. In the last analysis, it's just a relationship in which human beings try to find release and fulfillment, and they don't ask so very much to come first with someone, to be needed, to help someone, and to be needed by someone. These three, that's all, but that's enough. Now, next week, I'd like to be even more simplistic. The subject is how to keep a good thing going. And I want to make just two basic suggestions that have really helped me in my marriage and I think will help you. We'll have a 3-minute break and then I'll talk back. Thank you. Good evening.